Welcome, everyone, to today's Clouin Internet Seminar, again entitled OSC Readiness Presents, which will cover environmental statute basics, which has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Jean Balance, and I come from the same program here at EPA, and I'll be helping to moderate today's seminar. Again, we're scheduled to begin at 1 p.m. Eastern, and I'm going to cover a couple of basic housekeeping items and reminders for participants to give a few additional attendees a few seconds to hop on the line before we kick off the formal presentation. A reminder for today's Internet seminar that, just as in all Clouin seminars, individual participants need to have a copy of the presentation materials available and open in front of them, and will be manually guided through the materials at verbal cues. So each individual participant must advance through the materials at cues from our instructors. If you have a printed copy of the slides in front of you, I'm going to ask everyone to move or turn the page to slide number 2 away from the title slide onto our housekeeping slide. Again, if you don't have a copy of the slides in front of you, you can obtain a copy from either the reminder or confirmation email messages you should have received, or also going to the seminar homepage, which is the same page that you used to register. On that homepage, you'll find links at the bottom of the page where you can actually download the slides as PowerPoint or PDF, or alternatively, you can click a button on the side of the seminar homepage that says Go to Seminar and look at the slides through a web browser window. Those of you who are looking at the slides through a web browser window, you can use the numbered links that appear on the left-hand slide to navigate through the materials, or simply use the buttons that appear along the top of the slides in orange circles. The single arrow pointing to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. Reminder to those of you on the phone lines, we do ask that you keep your phone on mute. We do not want you to put the call on hold. There could be background music or commercials that will be disruptive. So you can either use your own mute button or simply hit *6 to mute your phone now. We're going to hold questions for our instructor until the end of the formal presentation materials. At that time, those of you on the phones are welcome to unmute to ask your questions directly. I'll remind you again, you can unmute by hitting *6, but until then, we ask you again, keep yourselves on mute with the *6 command. As I mentioned, our questions will be held at the end of the formal presentation, but those of you who are looking at the slides online and streaming the audio are welcome to type up electronic questions at any point, which again, I'll hold and then read out loud on your behalf to the instructor when we get to the appropriate time for questions and answers. If you're looking at the slides through a web browser window, you'll see a question mark icon that appears at the top of those slides. As long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, if you click on that button, a new window will open up, which will allow you to type up your questions or comments. And again, at the appropriate time, I'll read them out loud on your behalf to the instructor. As I mentioned, our instructor will be indicating as they move through the material, so each one of you will have to manually advance the slides on your own. I just wanted to remind everyone that when we're done today, we are going to point you to two final links on the last slide, one of which is a link of resources for today's seminar where you can download not only today's presentation, but a variety of other materials that are related to the topic. And the other link we'll point you to is a short feedback form. If you're looking to get credit for participating today, when you complete feedback, you can actually have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records. And I'll cover reminders on how to get that and how to submit the feedback at the end of today's session. Lastly, I want to remind everyone that today's session is being recorded. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to prepare an archive session, but when that session or when the session is available, you will automatically receive an email from me with the links to download and replay the session for free online. And you're welcome to certainly forward that link on to others that you think might find this seminar useful. I think with that, that is the end of the official reminders I have today for today's session. So I'm going to ask everyone to move along to slide number 3. And at this point, I'm going to turn things over to our instructor, who is Therese Joya from Tester Tech. Therese, are you ready?
Yes, thanks, Jean.
Thank you.
Welcome, everybody. This course is called Basics of Environmental Statutes. It was actually developed by Steve Mason, who is an on-scene coordinator in Region 6. And the purpose of the course was to give other on-scene coordinators a better idea of how EPA is operating its other programs outside of Superfund. And so what we've done for this two-hour presentation is taken portions of that course to present in a two-hour webinar. And so what I'm going to cover today is environmental laws and how they come into being, a little history of EPA, a little civics lesson on how laws are actually passed and how regulations that help implement those laws are also passed, And then I'll talk and focus on TSCA, which is the Toxic Substances Control Act, and the Clean Water Act. And so I'll go over the history of those two acts and the programs that EPA implements under both of those acts. Again, my name is Therese Joya. I work for Tetra Tech, and I've been involved in CERCLA response for the past 27 years. So I've been involved in working on response actions, both in the removal and remedial side of the Superfund program. So let's move on to slide 4. So our environmental laws are the sets of statutes, rules, guidelines, policies, and also judicial and administrative interpretations of those laws. And all of that volume of information really is the environmental programs in the United States. And depending on the program that you're working in, it can be a regulatory program like the Clean Air Act or the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or it could be more of a response program, which is what the Superfund law does. And then, as most of you probably know, most environmental laws have resulted from some sort of catastrophe that comes to public attention, and then, you know, lawmakers and the public say, you know, there ought to be a law about that particular thing that happened, and then laws get made. So let's take a look at a few of those that have come into being based on a catastrophe. That is on the next slide. So the EPCRA law, which is the Community Right to Know Act, really started based on an incident in Bhopal, India, which was the release of methyl isocyanate from a Union Carbide facility. This methyl isocyanate gas is a very deadly gas. It killed 5,000 people in India initially, another 18,000 within 2 weeks of the incident, and then 8,000 since that release first occurred. And there was a facility in the United States that also had methyl isocyanate, and so that was a big impetus to actually put EPCRA into existence. The CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, was really passed by a number of sites that came to the public's attention, including Love Canal in New York and the Valley of the Drums in Kentucky, and the Stringfellow Acid Pits, another old and famous site in California. And these sites provided the impetus to actually pass the Response Act, which is CERCLA. The Clean Water Act is one of our oldest statutes, and it was passed because the Cuyahoga River in Ohio caught on fire. And I went back and pulled a little information about the fire on the Cuyahoga River that actually provided the impetus to pass the new version of the Clean Water Act. But that fire happened in June of 1969, and there was an oil slick and debris on the Cuyahoga River, and it caught fire and burned for 30 minutes. And the cause was most likely sparks from a train that was passing over a bridge and that fell into the water and ignited it. But it actually wasn't the first time the Cuyahoga burned. There are recorded fires in 1868, 1883, 1887, all the way up until 1952, and then the 1969 fire was sort of the one that the straw that broke the camel's back, at least for updating the Clean Water Act. The Oil Pollution Act was a direct consequence of the Exxon Valdez and Megaborg transportation spills, and the Clean Air Act amendments that started the risk management plans. That was That was done because of a series of very deadly explosions and releases in the late 80s. So environmental statutes usually come into being after something, either a series of terrible things happen or one terrible thing, like Bhopal, India. All right, let's move on to slide number 6. We're going to take a few minutes and talk about how EPA came into being, and it was actually started, I'm on now slide 7, it was actually started by President Nixon, and he started in July of 1970, started a reorganization plan where he wanted to create an independent agency that wasn't under the control of any other department, and that became the Environmental Protection Agency. And it consolidated a number of activities that were conducted by many different agencies into the one Federal Environmental Protection Agency. And it had, in fiscal year 10, a budget of $10.5 billion and about 17,000 full-time employees. We have a couple slides on how the budget for EPA has, budget and staffing has gone over the years. So slide 8 shows you EPA's budget since 1996. And it was at a high of $10.5 billion in fiscal year 2010. You could see from the next slide that there are a little over, about 17,500 full-time employees at EPA now. The very highest was 18,000, and that was in fiscal year 99. So it's remained pretty steady between 17,000 and 18,000 since 1996. One of the things that really spurned the started the environmental movement in the United States, and I actually recommend this book to anyone who hasn't read it yet, is Silent Spring. It was written by Rachel Carson, and the silence of the spring had to do with the use of pesticides that were killing off songbirds. And she did her research, and she wrote this book talking about, you know, how springs are getting more silent because of the use of these very damaging commercial pesticides. And the book attracted a lot of attention. And it led to the very first Earth Day celebration on April 22nd in 1970. And 20 million Americans came out to celebrate the very first Earth Day. And it's become a celebration that EPA conducts every year on April 22nd. There were quite a few activists out there on April 22nd, 1970. And as you know, there are many activist environmental organizations that are still doing that very same thing today in terms of lobbying and demonstrations on environmental issues. But if you haven't read Silent Spring, it is a really very good book, and it was ahead of its time in terms of its position on the effects of chemicals in the environment. On the next page, on the next slide, slide 11, you can see which of the agencies' activities were merged into the Environmental Protection Agency. So some portion of the work done by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, the Department of Interior, the Department of Agriculture, of those agencies and departments that had been doing environmental work, that shifted then down to the Environmental Protection Agency. And the first administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency was William Ruckelshaus, and he actually came back to be administrator of EPA again in the early 1980s. This shows you the agency seal, gives a little history of how that seal was developed. It was actually developed by an Indianapolis advertising agency called McQuaid, Wilkins, Bloomhorst, Newman, and Colbert, or Colbert, however you would pronounce that. And it was done at no charge to EPA. Ken Bloomhorst was the illustrator. And the flower, the whole seal itself was supposed to represent the environment. The blue sky, the green earth, the blue-green water, and then the actual white circle that the seal is on is supposed to represent the sun and the moon. There is an EPA order, 1015.2A, on that provides directions for use of the agency's official seal. On slide 13, Nixon explained that EPA's mission was to establish environmental protection standards for various media to conduct the environmental research necessary to better regulate the activities that were occurring and to provide assistance to others, such as states, that were combating environmental pollution. It was also to assist the Council on Environmental Quality in developing new policies for environmental protection that they were needed to recommend to the president. Even though laws were in existence, it was recognized that new and different laws needed to be passed and regulations needed to be developed to address those problems. And EPA's official birthday is December 2nd, 1970. On slide 14, these are the major environmental statutes that the EPA administers. And they essentially deal with all of the media as well as all of the types of chemicals that might be produced. I'm not going to read them all. These are some other statutes, so the list goes on. And then there are some important executive orders that EPA has to pay attention to. And then finally, some other laws on slide 16, some other laws that influence the processes and the policies that are conducted. The Administrative Procedures Act, the Freedom of Information Act, these are laws that can cover any activity conducted by the federal government. And so they also apply to EPA's statutes also. All right, on slide 17, you can see generally how EPA is organized. There's the administrator and deputy administrator. Lisa Jackson is the current administrator of EPA. And then there are 9 assistant administrators and the general counsel and inspector general. And then there are 10 regions. And the real work, the boots on the ground work, occurs in the regional offices. And as you can see, there are 10 of them, and the map on the next page shows you how the regions are divided, how the states are divided among each of the regions. You can see that by the color coding. And so each regional office then administers these federal statutes in the states that region covers. And each regional office has a regional administrator. All right, that was the sort of history of EPA in a nutshell. And now we're going to move on to our little civics lesson on lawmaking and rulemaking. So if you could move on to slide 20. I'll talk about the process for making a law. The process begins when the bill or the resolution is numbered. And if it begins in the House, then it is has an HR before the number, and if it begins in the Senate, it has an S before the number. The bills are then referred to appropriate committees within each, both the House and the Senate for consideration. And those committees can hold hearings, they can conduct studies, they do a lot of investigation, and they issue reports and recommend whether or not a bill should go forward for passage or not. So a lot of work and study is done in committees within the House and the Senate. On slide 21, the process continues. After the committee, the bill is then placed on the calendar of the respective chamber, either the House or the Senate, and then it's considered by the full body. It's debated, and it may be voted on. And after debate and approval of the amendments, then the bill is either passed or defeated. Now, generally, the House and the Senate will pass different versions of the same bill, the bill trying to do the same thing. And so it goes into a congressional conference where members of the House and the Senate resolve differences between the two versions, put together a version that will go then into both the House and the Senate to be voted on for passage. I'm on slide 22 now. So the bill from the conference committee would go to both the House and the Senate, and then they would act to pass that. And if they did pass it, then the act would be sent to the president. And the law is signed, it becomes a law if it is signed by the president or if the president does not veto it in 10 days. It also becomes a law. If the president vetoes it, the Congress can attempt to override the veto, but that requires a two-thirds vote to override a presidential veto. And then once the law is passed, it becomes an act. And however, as all of you know, working in the environmental or any regulatory program, the laws often don't include enough details to actually implement a program. And what many of the acts do is they give power to an administrative agency like EPA to then take that statute and make regulations, which would provide additional details for how to actually to implement that act. The president can also give an agency authority to promulgate regulations through an executive order. It takes a while to promulgate these regulations. The CERCLA was amended by SARA in 1986, but it took 4 years to actually revise the regulation that implements CERCLA, which is the NCP or National Contingency Plan. So there can be a gap between the time when a law is passed or amended and the time when the regulations catch up with that particular new law. I'm on slide 24. There is a process that has to be followed to establish a regulation at the federal level. And the federal regulation first has to be proposed in the Federal Register, and then the agency proposing the regulation seeks comment, and those comments have to be responded to, and the rule is then published again in the Federal Register as being finalized, and then it's codified in the Code of Federal Regulations. And that's the little photo you see there on this slide. That's a standard CFR that you would be able to obtain. And most of the environmental statutes are either in Title 40 or Title 33 of the Code of Federal Regulations. However, I just want to make a note here that The Code of Federal Regulations doesn't have any of the preamble to final regulations, and it's in that preamble to final regulations that you'll find the agency's discussion of why they are writing the rule the way they are writing it. And so I think it's really handy to always have the Federal Register copy of the final regulations so that you can have that preamble. The preamble to the 1990 National Contingency Plan is really useful when you're working through issues in the removal program and the remedial program. So for those of you just depending on the CFR, I would highly advise you to try to get a copy of the preamble to final regulations that you work with. Now, each year, the federal government issues about 130 substantive regulations that apply nationwide. And of these, only 5 to 10 usually are considered major. And by the way they are considered being major is the cumulative cost impact that they may have. I think that's all I'm going to say about regulations. Now, actually, it's not the last thing I'm going to say. In addition to the statute, the executive orders, and the regulations, there's also a large body of policy and guidance that EPA publishes, which is very useful when you're working in any of the programs. So, any environmental program you're working with, you can find a lot of great information from EPA in terms of policy and guidance that will answer questions that the statute and regulation can't. All right, let's look at slide 25. There has been a growth in the passage of federal environmental laws, and this is since 1870, so you can see there's a very sharp increase starting around the 1960s, but that would be expected when you're going back so far in time. All right, so that's the little civics lesson. And now I'm going to talk about, first of all, TSCA, the Toxic Substances Control Act, and then I will talk about the Clean Water Act. So I am moving from slide 26. To slide 27. So TSCA is a unique regulation in that it allows EPA to determine the hazard of a product or a chemical before it is used in commerce. So that was the idea. Before you introduce a new chemical into commerce, you as the introducer should be able to determine whether or not it has any hazards, and then EPA through TSCA will regulate how that product can be used. And this was the idea of let's make them safe before they get into commerce instead of letting them into commerce and then finding out they are not safe. It does require companies to conduct toxicity tests of chemicals that they want to introduce into commerce. And EPA is required by TSCA itself to regulate any chemical that presents an unreasonable risk. And EPA's actions can be anywhere between a range of a total ban, which would be the most aggressive action, to warning labels, which would be the least activity they could take. So it's a broad range of regulatory tools that EPA has on how these chemicals can be used. I'm on slide 28 now. You can see TSCA was first passed in 1976, and then there were several amendments, mainly the amendment for asbestos, which I'll talk about later, and then another amendment for radon, and then finally an amendment to address lead-based paint. And I'll talk about all three of those amendments in a little bit. And moving on to slide 29. So the Council on Environmental Quality originally proposed that something like PASCA be passed in 1971. However, Congress couldn't agree on the scope and the cost, and so nothing happened until a few large incidents led to the passage of PASCA in October of 1976. One of those events that happened was the Hudson River PCBs, the discovery of a very large amount of PCB sediment contamination in the Hudson River, and the polybromated biphenyl problem or contamination that occurred in Michigan. Now, I grew up in Michigan, and I graduated in 1976, so I was actually living there when this incident happened. So I'm going to talk a little bit about it, what the PBB problem was. It actually, the incident occurred in 1973 when the polybromated biphenyls, it does the same thing PCBs does. It sets fires. I'm not being very eloquent. And it was manufactured by the same company that also manufactured magnesium oxide, which is a cattle feed. And it was sold under the trade name of Nutrimaster. And there was a shortage of these pre-printed bags that held 10 to 50 pounds of the PBB. And so accidentally, PBB was placed in the bags that were supposed to have the cattle feed, and the PBB was then distributed to feed mills and was used in the production of feed mainly for dairy cattle. The mix-up wasn't discovered until 1974, but by that time, PBB, which acts very much like PCBs, entered the food chain through milk and dairy products, beef products, contaminated swine, sheep, chickens, and eggs. And as a result of this incident, over 500 contaminated Michigan farms were quarantined, and approximately 30,000 cattle, 4,500 swine, 1,500 sheep, 1.5 million chickens had to be destroyed and buried. And then 800 tons of animal feed, 18,000 pounds of cheese, 2,500 pounds of butter, 5 million eggs, and 34,000 pounds of dried milk products had to be destroyed. So it was a really big deal in Michigan. There's actually a very good video, a documentary video about it called The Poisoning of Michigan, if you were interested in looking that up and checking it out. So these two incidents really led to concern over the fact that there were chemicals like PCBs and PBB out in the environment, and folks really didn't know what their effects were. So that led to the passage of PASCA, and that's on slide 30. It requires the manufacturers and processors to test their existing chemicals if an unreasonable risk is present, if the data is insufficient to determine the risk, or if testing is needed. And it prevents future risk through testing and tracking of new chemicals. It controls unreasonable risk by regulating how a particular risky chemical can be handled and used in commerce. And then it provides a lot of information about chemicals and the potential effects of those new chemicals. So EPA had sort of two issues to deal with here. One was, what about the existing chemicals that are already out in commerce and we don't really understand them very well? And then how do we deal with new chemicals that manufacturers want to put into commerce? And so they set off on those two tracks to look at the list of existing chemicals and then to start to control new chemicals that might be introduced. I'm on slide 31. So manufacturers of these chemicals had to develop data for their set of existing chemicals and determine whether or not an EPA, based on that data, can determine whether or not the chemical presents an unreasonable risk. And also, if a chemical was used in a very large, produced and used in large quantities that could potentially have a large release, they were also required to develop data on those existing chemicals. And then EPA would require tests if there was insufficient or no data for a particular chemical. We'll move on to slide 32. When a company wants to introduce a new chemical into commerce, they have to notify EPA at least 90 days prior to the introduction of that chemical. They have to submit all test data to EPA, and then EPA reviews the test data to determine how or if they need to prohibit any of the planned activities for that particular chemical. Companies also have to notify EPA when they want to use an existing chemical for a new use, because that may require them to EPA to actually evaluate and limit or prohibit its use. I'm on slide 33. So EPA has to evaluate the chemical risks and then make rules to protect against the unreasonable risk, or they have to determine that there is no unreasonable risk based on the available data. So those are the two things EPA is trying to figure out with the data that they get for new and existing chemicals. This shows the screening process that EPA uses to conduct their task screening. It identifies and controls potential hazards associated with chemicals that may be introduced. And if the data is inadequate, EPA can either prohibit the introduction of that chemical into commerce or limit the activities conducted with that chemical until the adequate data is submitted. The next slide, slide 35, gives you a list of EPA's options for regulating the chemical based on their evaluation of the risk it poses. They can either prohibit or limit its production or distribution. They can make sure that it is only used for a very specific use. They can limit the volume and concentration of the chemical that's produced. They can regulate how it is used, the warning labels and instructions that the chemical comes with. They can require notification of risk. They can require record keeping, and then they EPA can also require specific disposal methods depending on the chemical. I'm on slide 36. So one part of EPA's job here under TSCA is to maintain this inventory. And this inventory, when they first started out, there were 55,000 chemicals, and that was in 1979. Today, there are 84,000 chemicals on the TSCA existing chemical list. And TSCA covers many types of chemicals, organics, inorganics, polymers, and UVCBs, which are chemical substances of unknown or variable composition, complex chemical reactions, and biological materials. TSCA, however, does not cover chemicals that are regulated under other environmental programs, such as food and additives, pesticides, drugs, cosmetics, tobacco, nuclear material, or munitions. The TSCA inventory is now available online, and this was something done under Lisa Jackson, and it is now available online for free, so you can find out if a chemical is on the list of 84,000, and that is at EPA's data.gov site. So chemicals that are not listed on this list, which is now 84,000 long, are considered new, and they are subject to these to the pre-manufacturer notification requirements that EPA has established. And chemicals are then reviewed by EPA, and they may be added to the list if the manufacturer submits to EPA a notice of commencement, or an NOC. So once EPA receives an NOC, then the chemical would get added to the existing list and become, you know, part of the 84,000. And just to give you an idea, EPA receives between 500 and 1,000 NOCs, or notice of commencement to manufacture or import, each year. And so they are conducting at least 500 to 1,000 reviews of pre-manufacture notification reviews each year under TSCA. All right, on to 37. If EPA determines that there is an imminent hazard, they have authority under TSCA to seek court orders to control chemicals with unreasonable risk. And this would be an emergency action through a district court. Moving on to slide 38. Because TSCA deals with chemicals that companies want to introduce into commerce, there's a lot of confidential business information that is provided about the chemical, and that has to be very carefully guarded by EPA. There are penalties against the wrongful disclosure of confidential data, and so that the CBI information has to be kept locked up and secured, and it can't be given to other businesses. All right, another part of TSCA is the Title II, which is asbestos. Essentially, it's the Asbestos in Schools program. And this happened because there was a growing public concern about the presence of asbestos in buildings and especially in schools. And so TSCA was amended in 1988 with the Asbestos Hazard Emergency Response Act. It required EPA to set standards for responding to the presence of asbestos in schools. And these standards were set at levels adequate to protect public health and the environment and identify appropriate response actions. And then it required schools to inspect for asbestos-containing materials and then develop and implement a plan for managing that material. However, the law does not contain any deadlines for schools to complete implementation of this particular program. I'm on slide 40 now. Title II also required asbestos contractors and laboratories to be certified, and that any abatement work that was done in schools had to be conducted by certified asbestos contractors. This also applies to all work in all public and commercial buildings. So when you have asbestos-containing material, you have to get a licensed and certified contractor to conduct that work for you. And The requirements for buildings to be inspected for asbestos did not extend to non-school buildings. So the inspection portion only applied to schools. The rest of it is really voluntary for other types of buildings. So that was TSCA amended to incorporate the Asbestos in Schools program. In October of 1988, TSCA was amended to incorporate radon programs. And the radon programs provide financial and technical assistance to the states. It's an optional program. It's not mandatory. And it really is one where EPA provides information and assistance. On slide 42, EPA was required to update a pamphlet called A Citizen's Guide to Radon. It was required to develop model construction standards, to provide technical assistance to the states, to establish this clearinghouse for information, publish public information materials, and then establish a database of radon levels. EPA has done all this work. It has regional radon training centers. There's one for the eastern, southern, western, and midwest regions. And if you go to that website, you'll find just a ton of information about radon, how to detect radon, what levels cause concern, how to address radon intrusion into your home if that is a particular problem. So there's just lots of information out there, and this information came into being as a result of TSCA. Moving on to slide 43. Title 4 of TSCA deals with lead exposure reduction, and it was meant to help speed federal efforts up to reduce risk to children exposed to lead-based paint and to stimulate private lead inspection and hazard abatement services. And lead was used as a pigment in paint. Lead chromate gave paint a yellow color, and lead carbonate gave paint a white, very white color. Unfortunately, lead paint tastes sweet. Therefore, it encouraged children to eat, actually, lead chips or to put toys with lead dust into their mouths because it actually tasted sweet to them. And, of course, you know, lead ingestion is for children is a very bad thing. And what the Title IV did was it required EPA to define definitions of what lead-based hazards are, to certify lead detection personnel and lead abatement contractors, and to start an accreditation program for lead workers. It developed criteria to establish or determine the effectiveness of various lead paint control products on the market. It developed protocols for laboratory analysis, and then it provides a list of accredited environmental sampling laboratories. So that if you are, let's say, a homeowner who is rehabbing a very old house, you can get a lot of information and you can find qualified contractors to help you abate the lead in your own home. So it's really capacity building by EPA. And it directed development of the clearinghouse and the hotline, and those are still in existence, an information pamphlet, and then public education and outreach. Now, this particular, we found out that this particular graphic on this slide isn't real. but in reality, lead-based paint did taste really good. So even though this is not an actual advertisement, it's actually what happened. All right, and then finally, let's talk a little bit about PCBs and TSCA. if you're working in the removal program or the remedial program, you probably already have dealt with PCBs. It's a very common contaminant that we find at Superfund sites. TSCA actually banned the manufacture, processing, distribution, and use of PCBs except in a totally enclosed manner. And so over the years, they've been removed from commerce, and EPA promulgated the regulations that govern PCBs. And those PCB regulations are found in 40 CFR Part 761. And in 1978, EPA had promulgated several rules addressing all of the aspects of the life cycle of PCBs, and they had a spill policy that was also developed in as the regulation moved on. And then that spill policy was actually codified in 1998, so it is no longer a policy, but it's actually a regulation. And it provides cleanup levels for self-implementing portions of the regulation, and it gives cleanup levels for high occupancy residential as equal to or less than one part per million of PCBs, and for low occupancy residential less than 25 parts per million of PCBs. So the cleanup numbers are now codified in the TSCA regulations. They also have cleanup levels for non-porous surfaces that are contaminated with PCBs. And then the PCB regulations, they may become an applicable or relevant and appropriate requirement for you at your Superfund site. And the TSCA regulations spell out how PCBs, PCB contaminated materials or PCB liquids, how they are to be disposed of depending on the level of PCBs that is in a particular waste. And RCRA can also apply to the way that PCBs are regulated. They are regulated under RCRA if they have greater than 50 parts per million as a liquid, and if they are a non-liquid, if they have greater than 1,000 parts per million of halogenated organic compounds. So they can fall under both the RCRA regulation and the TSCA regulation. So that is really TSCA in a nutshell. It's unlike the statutes, other statutes, because it's EPA's attempt to regulate risks and sort of judge risks of chemicals and regulate that risk before that chemical is introduced into commerce, and then taking a look at all of the contaminants in commerce now to determine whether or not they have an unreasonable risk. All right, that is it for TSCA. Now I'm going to move into the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, or the Clean Water Act. So I'm moving from slide 48 to slide 49. So the Clean Water Act was the federal government's first comprehensive showing that they had a federal interest in clean water programs. And they were first designed to provide technical assistance funds to address water pollution. And pollution was viewed in water was viewed as a state and a local problem. So there were no federal rules or guidelines at the beginning of the Clean Water Act program. You can see here on slide 50 that the Federal Water Pollution Control Act was first prepared in 1948. So it's one of the earlier federal environmental laws. And it's been amended several times. Some of the more significant amendments occurring in 1972 and then again in 1977. One of the amendments that is not on here, that is very near and dear to those of us working in the Superfund program, is the 1990 amendment for the Oil Pollution Act. In the 1950s and 60s, there were four laws or amendments to the Clean Water Act law that changed how the United States was dealing with its water pollution program. The federal government started to provide assistance to municipal dischargers and enforcement for all of those dischargers. And federal jurisdiction was extended to include navigable intrastate as well as interstate waters. And then water quality standards were added in 1965 to set standards for those interstate waters. In 1972, the Clean Water Act was amended, and it set up some new components and some very optimistic and ambitious goals. The 1972 amendments required that all municipal and industrial wastewaters be treated before being discharged into waterways. It increased federal assistance for municipal treatment plant construction. It strengthened and streamlined enforcement, and it expanded the role, the federal role, while retaining the responsibility of states for day-to-day implementation of the law. I'm on slide 53. So these were the two big goals established. They are still goals under the Clean Water Act. And that was zero discharge of pollutants by 1985 and water quality that is fishable and swimmable by 1983. So the program continues forward and with the effort to meet those two very big goals sometime in the future. The two main parts, I'm on slide 54 now, the two main parts of the Clean Water Act are the portion that provides federal financial assistance to municipal sewage treatment plant construction and improvements. And then the other part of the program is the regulatory part that applies to industrial and municipal discharges of pollutants to surface water. The municipal wastewater treatment construction grants are provided and have been provided by the federal government to sewage treatment facilities since 1956. And there has been $76 billion in Clean Water Act funds that have been appropriated to aid wastewater infrastructure plant construction since 1972. And two factors are looked at in order to decide how that money will be allocated, and that is the state population and then an estimate of the municipal sewage treatment funding needs. And that is derived from a biennial survey that is conducted by EPA in the states. So the importance of the census is very striking here in that the federal census is used to establish the state population that will then be used to establish how this funding is allocated. All right, and then let's look at the other side of the program, which is one that affects the work that we all do on our Superfund sites much more strongly. And this was sort of the permit and regulation side of the Clean Water Act that looks at what is discharged to surface water. And it adopted the concept that all discharges into the nation's waters are unlawful unless they are authorized by a permit. And there are more than 65,000 industrial and municipal dischargers that have to obtain permits either from EPA or a qualified state, and those permits are under the National Pollution Discharge Elimination System Program, and that's authorized by Section 402 of the Clean Water Act. And an NPDES permit is required to attain technology-based effluent limits, best practical control, either BPT, which is best practicable control technology currently available, or BAT, best available technology. So these permits require a particular control technology, and they'll also have effluent limitations for all of the contaminants that are being controlled and a deadline for compliance with that discharge effluent limitation. All right, moving on to slide 57. The discharger has to monitor and maintain records. They have to report to the regulating agency, whether it's the state or EPA, and to show that they are in compliance with their permit. And then there are enforcement provisions that would kick in for noncompliance. On slide 58, so the technologies focus on conventional pollutants and toxic pollutants. And conventional pollutants are those such as bacteria or temperature, turbidity, biological oxygen demand, chemical oxygen demand. And then the BPT limitations focus on the conventional pollutants. And the best available technology limitations focus on the toxic pollutants, such as heavy metals, pesticides, and other organic chemicals. And in addition to the limitation applicable to certain categories of industry, EPA has also issued water quality criteria for more than 115 pollutants, including 65 named classes or categories of toxic chemicals or priority pollutants. And then these criteria are used by states to establish water quality standards for the various water bodies in the state. In addition, ambient water quality criteria may be an applicable or relevant and appropriate requirement under CERCLA. The statute actually names ambient water quality criteria as potential ARARs. And then also, if you're conducting a Superfund action, the NPDES permit limitations would also be an ARAR for you if you are discharging treated water to a surface water body. Another part of the Clean Water Act that relates to the permitting and regulatory side is the requirement to permit disposal of dredged or fill material into the nation's waters, including wetlands. And the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers administers this program using EPA's guidance. And the Wetland Permit Program has become one of the most controversial parts of the law. Some who wish to develop wetlands maintain that federal regulation intrudes on and impedes private land use decisions, while environmentalists seek more protection for remaining wetlands and limits on activities that take place in wetlands. And this tension continues to this day. The Clean Water Act also regulates non-point sources of pollution, which is the stormwater program. And the stormwater regulations cover three types of activities. Construction sites that are affecting 1 acre or more, industrial sites, and municipal separate stormwater systems. And the requirements for managing runoff from your construction site may also be applicable to activities that are occurring during a Superfund removal or remedial action. And so this would likely be an ARAR for you at a Superfund action if you're doing any sort of construction that disturbs more than 1 acre of land. And the permit requirements are essentially to develop and implement a stormwater pollution prevention plan, which spells out how you're going to control or prevent stormwater pollution from your construction site, what sorts of best management practices you're going to use. And then it requires you to submit a notice of intent and then a notice of termination. So what exists is a general, it's called a construction general permit. EPA, the federal government, has one. And then most states that are approved by EPA to implement this program also have a general permit. And you get folded into this general construction permit by putting together your stormwater pollution prevention plan, notifying EPA of when, or the state of when, you're going to be conducting your activities at the construction site, and then notice of termination when you have concluded your activities at the construction site. So this is something to pay attention to ensure that you're complying with the stormwater pollution prevention regulations. There are a handful of states that do not have the program where EPA is the lead, and those are Alaska, American Samoa, Guam, Idaho, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Northern Mariana Islands, Puerto Rico, trust territories, tribal lands, it says most but not all, and Washington, D.C. So to obtain a stormwater permit for any one of these areas, you would use the EPA construction general permit process. All right, another part of the Clean Water Act is, and where it interfaces in a very large way with CERCLA, is in the spill reporting and in response to discharges of oil or hazardous substance to surface water. So the Clean Water Act requires that any oil or Clean Water Act hazardous substance that is discharged to navigable water, that and for oil, if it presents a sheen, that spill has to be reported to the National Response Center. The National Response Center is staffed by the U.S. Coast Guard, and they and the National Response Center takes that spill report and then determines who should respond from the federal government, and that would be either the Coast Guard itself or U.S. EPA, depending on where the spill originated. And then relies on the local OSC, on-scene coordinator, to determine what, if any, federal action is required for that discharge of oil. And the prohibition on a discharge of oil to surface water predated CERCLA, and there was what was called the revolving fund, which was a small federal fund that could be used to fund federal response under the Clean Water Act to discharges of oil and hazardous substances to surface water. So So back before CERCLA, this revolving fund was used to pay for federal response at discharges of oil to surface water. Since then, since the passage of CERCLA, and the NCP was updated to actually pull in hazardous substance releases into the already existing National Contingency Plan. And then through the Oil Pollution Act, it really strengthened oil response for the federal government and created the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, which was much, much larger than the revolving fund under the first Clean Water Act. The Federal Removal Authority is very unique in CERCLA and the Clean Water Act, but it does give the president, and the president delegated this authority down to either EPA or United States Coast Guard OSCs to actually direct all actions to remove the spill if it presents a substantial threat to public health and the environment, and to require that all cleanup actions be conducted in accordance with the National Contingency Plan. And EPA and the Coast Guard can either oversee the responsible parties' cleanup, they can also send federal monies when the responsible parties' funding is not adequate to address the problem. So when the Clean Water Act was published, it required the 1972 amendments to the Clean Water Act required the president to actually prepare the National Contingency Plan, which is the federal regulation that implements both the portions of the Clean Water Act, the response portion of the Clean Water Act, and all of CERCLA. And the National Contingency Plan provides the framework to make sure that all of the actions are efficient and effective, and that they minimize or eliminate the damage from oil and hazardous substance discharges. And there is also a Oil Pollution Act also has provisions for those who have been harmed or damaged by the spill to seek reimbursement from the fund. Under the Clean Water Act, I'm on slide 64, there are a number of plans that have to be prepared and reviewed. There's the Spill Prevention SPCC plan, which is the Spill Prevention Countermeasure and Control Plan, and that's required for facilities that store a particular amount of oil. There's also facility response plans and vessel response plans that are required for facilities that store large amounts of oil or that could release a particular amount of oil. And these SPCC plans and facility response plans have to be reviewed by EPA and updated when necessary. And for the facility response plans, there's also requirements for conducting drills to actually make sure that their facility response plan can be implemented in case there is a large event at that facility. And SPCC plan review and inspections and facility response plan review, those fall under the purview of the Superfund program. On-scene coordinators get involved in assisting with that. All right, on to 65. That is really the conclusion of the Clean Water Act discussion, and that takes me to the end. Well, if you want to go to slide 66. And you can see there, when you fill out, if you need confirmation of your participation today, when you fill out the feedback form, just check that box there. It says, please send a copy of my feedback confirmation as a record of my participation to this address. And so if you check that and send in this form, then Gene Vallant will send you back a confirmation so that you can keep that for your records. Otherwise, you know, please fill out the feedback form and submit that. I'm sorry for those of you who had questions if you were on typing them in. Apparently, Jean has stepped away from her phone. But if nobody else on the phone has any questions, then I don't see any need to keep you. All right, well, please fill out the feedback form. Make sure you indicate if you need confirmation sent back to you. And then take a look at the additional resources and the other archived webinars that are available on CLUIN, as well as the stuff coming up in the near future. So thanks, everyone, for participating. I am going to sign off now.